And today's speaker explained that to me from this podium. And he didn't know it at the time, but he's been very instrumental. He knows it now. But he's been very instrumental in my sobriety and in my world, in my journey. And we keep adding new chapters. And my friend Roy, come on, buddy.
Sobriety date is January 15th of 2013, and I'm very grateful for that. Everybody hear me?
Yes.
Thank you, Curtis. I was just fine until I pulled up and saw all the cars. I am grateful to be alive and sober, grateful to be at an AA meeting, just happy to be speaking. I have a very rich, full, abundant, creative, how's that? Okay, how's that? Let's do this. How's that?
Perfect.
Good morning.
Good morning, boy.
So I love Club 12. I love AA. I love everything about recovery. I have a rich, full, beautiful, amazing, creative life that sometimes I have to pinch myself, but I get to live. So thank you for that. If I don't say anything else. I love Club 12, so I've got sober here, and I love everything about it. I love the smell of it. I just feel safe when I'm here. So thank you, Club 12. I was going to say something funny, but it slipped my mind, so I guess I should just tell my story. So I am number 6 of 7 children. My family was a military family, and we traveled the world. I was born in Turkey and lived in 22 different states. And I remember the first time I moved and left a friend, it was really hard. I just remember being so sad. And so we moved every year. We knew we were going to move, so I just never made friends, and I just kind of hung out with my big brothers and did whatever they did. And they smoked a lot of pot. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I was born in 66. And they smoked a lot of pot and I drank a lot. And so I had a very good childhood. My family was very close, touchy, feely, lovey. We loved her. We were huggers and we laughed a lot. So I had a good childhood. It's not my parents' fault. But at 13 is when I had my first huff of paint in a red bag. Weren't y'all huffing paint at 13? We used to huff paint in a red bag. So that was my first drug. And then I drank my first drink about 14. I just remember getting someone to buy us the old Milwaukee Quartz. And there's a part on the label where I knew I would start feeling different, and I hated it. But I would just drink until I could get to that part on the label that would make everything go away. So I probably was drinking alcohol from the beginning. No big trouble growing up. I always knew that was very special. There's 6 boys and 1 girl in my family, and it was very kind of a strict military family, and I knew I was gay in kindergarten, if you can believe that. But it was like, whoa, it wasn't a cool thing back then in the 60s or 70s or 80s. And I didn't want to be at all. So there was that drinking, trying to like forget that. But anyway, so I'll have to start with my party. I got a job at SeaWorld as a teenager when it first opened, and I met this girl. She was my friend, and she said, there's this bar called the Paper Moon that you should go to. That'll date you. Anyways, I went to this gay bar called the Paper Moon, and it was like, wow. And I drank and what have you, and the second time I went out to a bar, I saw this guy, he was beautiful. He looked like a young Ricky Ricardo, slick back hair. He looked a lot like Henry Ortega. Very serious. Very handsome Spanish. Very handsome. And I had very low self-esteem, and I just remember thinking, oh, someone like that would never like me. And the next moment, he was standing in front of me and said hello, and we were together for the next 10 years. We never separated. And that was my first love. He was a hairdresser. His name was Rico, and he was a rock star in the business, and we eventually opened up our own business in Alamo Heights, but the hairdressers know how to party. Like, they party. And so I was introduced to lots of cocaine and tequila. But we had a lot of success, partied a lot. Everyone we hung out with partied. So yes, there were a lot of times we overshot the mark, couldn't go to work. But by and large, had a successful career, and our families were very, very generous with their love to us. They spent their holidays at our house with Christmas and Easter. We had a family. It was beautiful. And then one day Rico got sick, and we got him tested for AIDS, and he turned up positive. And then I tested as well, and I was positive as well. I have been living with HIV and AIDS for over 32 years, and that's by the grace of God and AA, by the way. So all of our employees found out and left, and anyways, he just got really sick, very sick. And there was nothing available but AZT back then. It was very toxic. My parents were gracious enough to, I mean, they loved us very much. Rico used to go to Spurs games with my dad, so he was like a son to them. And so they paid our bills and let me take care of him. And he just got sick as you could be without an immune system. He went blind. He had a parasite in his brain. He had CMV retinitis. It was terrible. It was horrible. It wasn't pretty about it. But, you know, I got to be with him and take care of him, do the best I could. I will tell you that one of our clients came over to our house, and our master bedroom was an intensive care unit. And I ran 18 hours of IV meds through him every day. The closet was a supply closet. And the university hospital's nursing program used to send their nursing students over to my house to watch my dressing change techniques. It was very good. But one of our clients, But one of our clients came over one day, and she saw all that I was doing for him, and she said, "You should try this." And she handed me a big rock of crystal meth. Woo. It was my first. Yeah. Everything changed after that. But I used it. I justified it because I used it as fuel, and it kept me up, and I could take care of everybody. But so one time, Rico woke up in a completely different room in the house. Everything had been moved, IV poles, bed, and everything. Morning. That's what crystal meth did for me. This must be funny. I rearranged the house all the time. Anyways, so, you know, I don't talk a lot about that. It's just another, it seems like I've lived so many different lives. But I will tell you that I had a glimpse of a higher power back then. It was just so tragic. But there were moments where I could tell that there was something bigger than me doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, but I knew what it was. So, so Rico died in my arms in 1994, and as soon as he died, I went to our doctor, and they were like, "You have the same strands of the virus in your body. You're going to get a parasite in your brain. You're going to go blind." And like, that's what they told me, and so I just never went back. And I went out and found I just started drinking. I discovered Warm Southern Comfort. This is the drug of my choice. Something about Warm Southern Comfort burning its way down, but in a pile of anything I can shove up my nose. I love Trey Scott. He says his drug of choice was more. So, anyways. You know, I just went out. I went out and met all of you people. I met all of the after-hour people. I went to the bars and drank, and I did crazy stuff. I started doing drugs. I started doing drugs big time. And, you know, there's just not a whole lot of, there's just not a whole lot more I can say about that. But if you have been at the bottom and you do whatever you can to get high, drink, so I could tell you stories of what it was like, but you've all been there. So I drank until, I drank to oblivion, I got high to oblivion, I did it all. And I got a little bit of sobriety one time, briefly. I wasn't ready. So there's nothing else I think I need to say about my drunk log other than I've done it and plus extra. That's it. On October 12th of 1999, I woke up on a picnic table on the corner of Ashby and McCullough. There's a little bar called the Cobalt Club.
Yes.
Go cash your disability check at 7 a.m. Go no, I've been there. I was sleeping on a picnic table in a little, it's a little shack next to the Cobalt Club, and the owner let me sleep on the picnic table for about 3 weeks. I had burned everything to the ground, lost everything, I had gotten arrested with drugs, and the ground was saturated with beer, and so that's why I slept on a picnic table. I always say that I'm better than Jim, Red Jim, that used to work in a snack bar, that used to sleep on a park bench. But I was better than that. I slept on a picnic table. So I am 130 pounds. I have one black tooth right here. And I wake up on that picnic table. And I had in my pocket an expired passport and a desire chip and my driver's license. And so I'll tell you that one of my favorite parts of Alcoholics Anonymous is the moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers inside and outside the room, because I had zero intentions of coming back to AA, and I was prayed back here. I know that for a fact. I just know that. So I woke up from that picnic table, and I looked at the desire chip in my pocket, and it said, "To thine own self be true." And I got on a bus, and I came to Club 12. That was October 12th, 1999. And I walked right through that door, and I met Rod Benton, and he became my sponsor. And I just, like, I'm so grateful that I burned my life completely to the ground, because I was just not prepared for for them. That was creepy. And for God, I mean, everywhere, God, Jesus. Scared the shit out of people. And I was like really desperate, and we live and food, and so I just told Rod, I don't know if this is going to work for me. I know where to sleep, I need some food, and I'm probably going to go to prison. I have this drug charge against me, and he used to call me honey, and he would say, "Honey, I can't help you with any of that, but if you straighten out the spiritual malady, all of that will get taken care of." I didn't believe him at all, but I just had no other choice. So I had to empty all the ashtrays on the picnic on the tables and wipe them down before I could sit. And I had, if you weren't talking a solution, if you were talking bullshit, I had to get up and go to another table until I heard the solution. So I had to. I went to every meeting here at Club 12. There's seven a day. I went to every one of them. Threw myself right in the middle of AA. I had no choice. I was told to come to the dances. They had dances every other Saturday here, and I used to sit in the corner and drink water and eat peanuts. Like, what am I doing here? But there was a girl named Christine sitting at that table, selling door prize tickets, and she was sitting behind the table, and I had just come from the bars selling dope. I was like, they're not doing that right. So I went up to the table and I said, "Hey, I can help you sell those." So she gave me a big pile of tickets, and I went and worked the room and came back with a pile of money. And she was like, "Oh my God, here's more tickets." And then I became the door prize chairman of effing everything. Ever. Forever. I can sell the door prize tickets. but I got right in the middle of AA, right in the middle of service. I did not know it at the time. Well, so when I was still drinking and using, my fingernails stopped growing and I would cut myself and it wouldn't heal over weeks. And I knew I was dying. I felt it. Felt like I was rotting. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually ended up going to the doctor, and I had 5 T cells when I got sober. And you should have a few more than that. I was full blown AIDS when I got sober. I was sick. My face was pulled in. And again, Rod's like straight out the spiritual malady. I started seeing a doctor, and that was another whole other miracle. I got, she was blown away. I just got better so fast, so quickly, just because I was living in love, living in meetings, living in the steps. I was just opening my arms, not even knowing if it was real, but just willing to accept it, and I got better. I did get sick with pneumonia right after I got sober. I had PCP pneumonia, some bad pneumonia. And they put me in they put me in an isolation ward at the University Hospital. And it's one of those sealed off classrooms. And it was one night, I heard a bunch of commotion, and it was Joe McFadden with about 10 people, maybe about 12. And I heard the nurse yelling at him, him yelling at the nurse. They had put them all in chem gear, and they came into my room. And we had an AA meeting. But he took all their masks off and put them on me. Anyways, I was new. Shit. I was new. And I didn't even know any people. And that's how he treated me. Good, I got that over with. That's how we treat our new people. We love them until they can't love themselves. I had never experienced that kind of love. So that's how I started here. staying in the middle of service, just fast forward. So about a year sober, my sponsor said, "You don't look like you're dying anymore. You should probably go get a job."
It's good.
I had been given disability permanently, permanent disability. I had like they said, "He's gonna die." I get that. Anyways, they gave me permanent disability, and I started working with this lady counting postcards. Little shop in King William, I was counting 25 postcards at a time. That's my job. And I started making money, and my sponsor said, "You need to call the Social Security Administration and tell them that you are fully self-supported and decline their contribution." And that was the first huge leap of faith that I took in AA. One of those running leaps of faith where you just hope to God that you're going to get caught. And I did. I called them and told them I didn't want their check anymore. And the lady was like, "Are you sure, Mr. Hudgens? Because we're not going to review your case ever." Ever. I thought about it for a few minutes. But no, I didn't. I said, "Stop sending me the money." And about a week later, I had told her, like, exaggerated to my boss that I could get her cards into SeaWorld, her little postcards. I used to work there, and that ended bad, real bad, my job there. And she said, "Okay, here, I called them." She handed me the phone, and I called SeaWorld. This was a week after I gave up my disability, and one of my old managers, when I was a teenager, said, "Roy, we were just talking about you. We want to talk to you." And so I went in there, and they hired me as their private contractor, as their designer, to do all their window displays. So you're sober. Wow. Yes, they hired me. And I got to do 22 different window displays and in-store merchandising. And I just started going to Sermon on the Mount at Jim's office. So that book is based on letting go of what's good and accepting great, stuff like that. Claiming divine creativity, seeing yourself smiling where you want to be. Mm-hmm. Just kind of spooky shit. That was kind of spooky at first three. But I practiced it. And so, yeah, I'll tell you that one of my go-to, and still is today, if I'm scared or freaking out, I go to my knees and I ask God for help, and I always get an answer. And so I had one of those moments, and I'm sure you can identify. I'm at SeaWorld, I'm in a penguin window, decorating the window, and there's people watching me, and I had one of those moments where I felt like I don't belong here. I'm sort of toothless crackhead. What the fuck am I doing here? I had one of those moments where you just don't feel like you belong. Like, of course, Club 12. By the way, I couldn't go anywhere but Club 12 my first year. I couldn't go into a store. I went to Michael's one time and I almost threw up. There was so much stuff in there. I was just burning our lips over. But anyways, so I got on my knees in the window. Right in front of everybody. And just like, I need help. And I finished the window, and that was my signature window. The people from Fiesta, Texas saw that window, and they hired me after that as their designer. And I got to do all the Looney Tunes, Bugs Bunny character windows. That was so much fun. And I was learning how to pray, just looking for the presence of God and everything, every material. Like, there's so much merchandise at those parks that every piece of every single item comes from a different country. And so I learned how to do these expanded love units where you trace everything back to where it began. So much love and so much presence of love on everything. And that's just what it took for me to stop thinking about how worthless I was or anything else. I just, my foundation in AA is based entirely upon trusting and relying upon God. Like, it's all I know what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. Like, that's what's inside me. That's my foundation. So thank you. So I, again, had lost most of my teeth from drugs. I asked my sponsor, Jim, if I could pray for teeth. Because, yeah. And he said, why don't you pray for what you think new teeth will bring you? And so I did. And I was at Candlelight Coffee House with some friends, and I remember laughing out loud and not covering my mouth for the first time. I just can't help it. These are some turning points in my sobriety, so you're just going to have to hear me cry. Anyways, so I prayed for what new teeth would bring me, and I found out what it was like to be your authentic self and not worry about what you look like. And I had a moment. And then the next day, I was doing service work at a bake sale, and Dr. Tom from the 7 a.m. meeting came up to me and threw his card on the table and said, come see me, I'm going to fix your teeth. And so, these are my AA teeth. Yes, and there's a girl that got 30 days today. Her name's Michelle, and she's going to get new teeth one day, too. I met her last week. Yes, you can have new teeth, Michelle. So I had this rich, full, sober AA Club 12 life. My home group became the Hidens group. We got very involved in Weekend Essay, and we have Weekend Essay coming up next weekend. And Weekend Essay is such an opportunity to experience what the Fellowship of the Spirit is. I mean, it's amazing. You make lifelong friends. I've been involved with Weekend Essay for 18 years, minus a couple, I think. And there's people that come every year or miss a year, but they look for me. It's just such a great service opportunity, so better come next weekend. How's that, Debbie? All right, so I took the bus to Club 12, I think, for a year, every day, and that's where I learned how to pray. My sponsor told me to pray for everybody on the bus. Pray for everybody on the bus. And then I did that, and then I was like, hey, it's kind of boring. And he's like, well, why don't you claim what you think would be most fulfilling for everyone on the bus? I'm like, okay, I can do that. And so I would see a family walk on the bus, and I was like, she needs a new outfit. But I still do that today. So I got this job. I got offered to design a showroom over on 1604. By the way, that whole HIV/AIDS thing, like, I'm totally undetectable today, and I'm the healthiest I've been in my entire life. I mean, think about it. I don't
I'm confident that God's taking care of that, and it's not even an issue. So I kind of put it to rest. My higher power has that. So this man offered to hire me as a designer at this big showroom on 1604. It's a hot tub store. It's 20,000 square feet. Very pretty, beautiful showroom. And I went over there, and he sold hot tubs and toilets. I drew this pyramid of toilets. Like, that was my design concept. And he was like, can you sell? He wasn't impressed with my design concept at all. Anyways, I tried it, and I started working there as a part-time, as a little hot tub salesman, just part-time. And I never sold anything in my life, and so my sponsor suggested that I practice spiritual principles. And so I was taught how to tithe 10% of my thoughts to my customers as they're walking in the store, so I'm already praying for them, and I'm just being a channel of whatever God sees will be most fulfilling for them: abundance, creativity, harmony, love. So I started off praying before I even opened my mouth. And then when I was talking to them about the product, I was told to find a place in my presentation or during my conversation that would bring me back to the presence of love and God. And so there's a diverter valve on a hot tub. It's a little lever. And if you push it and turn it, it transfers the power from one station to the other. And so that was my moment where I would surrender again and go back to love and God. And so I would just, you know, talking about the hot tub. And then I would say, and this is the diverter valve. It gives you a choice in the direction of the flow. And like, I'm talking to the baby Jesus. But it was just a moment to not be in my in Roy, you know, in God's world. And I got very good at it. I was always top five in the world for 15 years. I was there, and I was the number one salesman several years in for Jacuzzi. But so I'm going to tell you one quick story about my court date before I tell you what happened after that. So when I was, I told you I was busted with drugs. My court date came up, and then I came out here. I made an SOS in the 7 a.m. meeting. I'm going to court. Everybody help me. You know how we do that? Come to court with me. And this creepy guy named Ed said, I'll come with you. And I was like, anybody else? My sponsor heard me, and he said, Roy, you need to make a choice. You need to live in Roy's world or God's world. You can't live in both. And I was like, all right, you can come with me, Ed. He met me there, and he showed up in a suit, and I didn't have a lawyer, and he went up to the little DA or whatever and came back, and he said, they're recommending 9 years in state prison. This would be a good time to have a lawyer. And I was like, I don't have a lawyer. And he said, well, I will represent you pro bono if you would like. And Ed was a big time defense lawyer. And he represented me, and he got me the judge sentenced me to 350 AA meetings. How about that?
Wow.
That's another turning stone in my sobriety where I draw on that also. So here I am, we're selling hot tubs right in the middle of AA, surrounded by people that build me up, not tear me down, just being successful mentally, physically, emotionally, socially, spiritually, every area that I let God in, I have success. And then I got 14 years of sobriety. Actually, it was 12 years of sobriety. I had something called the dark night of the soul. Some people call it divine discontent. It's when your sponsor doesn't, you hear blah, 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 blah. And then meetings don't mean anything. And you can't find God with a search warrant. And so instead of increasing my meetings or keeping my arms open, I started drifting. My sponsor and I broke up. I went to a priest to try to find God. Told him my whole story, and he was like, here's a Bible, see you later. And I drifted for 2 years. I wasn't consistent anywhere that I was would be missed. It was just isolating, NAA, just here and there, over there, just isolating, withdrawing, withholding, drifting. And I was in Maui, Hawaii in 2014, getting about to receive the number one salesman in the world award. I did not want to drink. I had planned on drinking. I did not set up a meeting before I left, which was very unusual. So I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, and my heart starts pounding like out of my chest, and I was picked up and catapulted to the bar. Like, I don't even remember, I remember I didn't have any shoes on. I just remember, like, running to the bar. Like, I ran to the bar and I started drinking. And I immediately blacked out. I came to once at a restaurant. My boss and his wife were sitting next to me, who'd never seen me drink. They've been to conferences I've chaired. Anyways, I came to bashing my fist on the table, demanding more wine. She looked at me like, oh my God, what are we going to do? Anyways, I blacked out for 3 days. I drank for 3 days straight. And there's pictures of the whole conference to prove it. But on the fourth day, I started calling my AA family. Tom, and I called Christine, and I just told her I'm going to die. I can't stop drinking. I'm still very afraid of it. Every cell in my body wanted to shrink, like, bad. Like, I had never experienced the progression of the illness. Like, you hear people in meetings saying, oh, my disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups. I would say that, but I've never had experience. I've never had sobriety and relapse. So I didn't know that it was real, but the progression is real. Like, it didn't pick up where I left off. It was like I was in a chokehold, and my face was being smashed against the ground. Like, I was terrified, and I couldn't stop, and I was screaming for more. So I just, in Maui, when you leave Maui, you have to fly out at 10 o'clock at night because the time change, and we had a whole day on the beach, where I was drinking. So I just walked the beach and called AA people and ate brownies. I made it to the airport that night, and my friend Lisa said, buy all the chocolate at the snack bar and eat as much as you can, or at the gift shop. And so I did. I shoved a bunch of chocolate in my mouth and got on the plane. I woke up 5 hours later in LA, and I did the same thing in LA. I shoved a bunch of chocolate in my mouth, and I woke up in Seattle, and I did it again from Seattle to San Antonio. So grace of God that I slept those three legs. And that was the Wednesday, and I got my desire chip at Hiding's. Sober. So that was January 15th of 2013, and have 5 years this next January. So I had experience with relapse. I came into the Sunday speaker meeting, and I kind of slithered in, and Terry said, hey, will you read the promises? I'm like, no, I can't. I just drank. She's like, good, give me your sobriety. So I got up here, and I told John my sobriety. But so, you know what, I don't care. I'm sober today. I didn't like my new sobriety. It took 2 years to actually accept it, but I have a gift now. I have a precious gift. I know what it's like to relapse. I know that the progression is real, and I know what it's like to drift, and I can smell you. I know when you're sneaking and being and drifting and pulling away, so I'm like on the hunt. I have a whole bunch of new sponsees that are potential drifters. But I have that gift now. So I also wanted to talk about how the promises, I know it's kind of cool that we say sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but that's not been my experience. The promises can happen now, like today, like right now. So as soon as I came back, I got right back into Weekend Essay. Sorry, I was the door prize guy. Okay, I guess I didn't have to reinvent the wheel. Like, what worked in 1999 worked in 2014. But right away, just got right back in the middle. There was something around my heart that I couldn't, like, I had built this concrete wall around my heart after Rico died. I was like, that will never happen again. It was traumatic. I probably should have been in therapy. But I just built a wall around my heart, and I wasn't willing to let anybody in that area of my life, romance, whatever. I just couldn't fucking do it. Anyways, so as soon as I got back, when I got sober, I got invited to design a condo at the new Broadway Tower. It was a penthouse, and my client was like, do whatever you want. And so one thing that my sponsor always taught me too is that you always come up to the chairperson after a meeting and thank them, or the speaker and thank them. That's something I do even in my business. I've always carried that with me. And so there was a concierge at the tower who was a really nice man, and he liked the muffins that they served on Thursdays from Broadway Daily Bread. And so every Thursday, I brought him a muffin, a pecan muffin. And one day, he overheard the VP of the building saying that they had bought the cover of a magazine for December, and they were looking for a condo to shoot. And he said, there's a really nice designer on 17 that brings me a pecan muffin every Thursday. And so they chose the condo that I designed to cover this magazine, and they flew in this photographer from New York. And I'm standing on the balcony, like shooting this. I did everything. It was custom everything, bedding, window treatments. I selected the china, the flatware. I did everything. And it was a dream project. It's all based on love and God. And so I'm standing on the balcony, and they're shooting the condo, and I'm looking at spaces, Concordia Word, and you can see across 281 the cluster of trees where the Cobalt Club is, where it's on a picnic table. And I've had one of those AA moments where, like, how did I end up here? Mm-hmm. How does that happen? I just showed up here to open up my arms. So. Okay, so another milestone, another opportunity. When I wake up and think that I'm going to starve and die, or the world's going to end, I can recapture the essence of some of those demonstrations and build on them. So this past year, I had another moment in the beginning of this year, 2017, where I started feeling discontent again, and I didn't even think about isolating or withdrawing or drifting. I just immediately started. Jim says it's an opportunity to expand your container, that I needed more room to fit more love, more God, more freedom, more creativity. And so I just expanded my AA world. And so I started going to other meetings around town, a big book study on Tuesday night. I started going to Lambda. I just was drawn over to Lambda. I had never gone to Lambda my entire 18 years there. I went over there, and I found there's a lot of good sobriety there, but I've heard stories of men and women that are traumatized by their families, like traumatized. Excuse me. Some of them, there's a lot of good sobriety there, but a lot of them don't believe they have access to a generous God. Mm-hmm. They just don't believe it. But I do. Like, that's all I know. Shit. So that's all I know. And so I've been so fortunate that I get to help people over there believe that they're perfect, complete, and whole, and that they have access to a huge God, a generous God, but not the one that sits on a throne that's okay every now and then, or sometimes you belong. It's the presence of love that lives within us. And that's where I found the good stuff. That's where it's at. And so I don't have to, like, please anyone else to get that. And I spent a lot of time trying to do that. But and then also I've been given a gift from them on how to be my true self and live my truth. So the other point I wanted to get across, that you can have a reawakening in AA with lots of sobriety. Mm-hmm. You can be 20 years sober and rediscover another level of fellowship, love, freedom. So, like Alcoholics Anonymous isn't just the big first year, 2 year kaboom. Like, my experience is that as much as I'm willing to surrender and keep my arms open, like, there's so much more God. And it's shit. So I had a problem with God just because of my own conception. But my sponsor taught me how to touch, feel, see, and smell love in anything, in anyone. So I just have a lot of tools, and I'm willing to share them with anyone. I have a bunch of new sponsees this year, and I do know that everybody in this room loves me. I have no question. So, thank you.
Thank you. Woo!
What you hear here, what you see here, when you leave here, let's stay here. All right, let's close with the Lord's Prayer.